Again and again, it seems to me, and always has, that we should see many major issues not as criminal issues but as public health issues. The ludicrous war against drugs is a classic case in point. Even drought, what we've been discussing with Paddy, even drought is a mental health issue as it applies to human beings. We've had a cluster of suicides of young farmers circling us in the bush, and the rate of these deaths is increasing. Environmental devastation also has its effect on the physical and psychological health of those who share the environment. Now, from an American or from an Australian perspective, it's all too easy to criticise and find fault with the American healthcare system. If you're rich and well-insured, you can get the best treatments money can buy, but if you're on the margins, it's a very different story, as we all know. But beyond the shortcomings of the US health system, and we should acknowledge ours has its faults too, there's a bigger picture, one that frames poor health as a consequence, not of personal choice or even genetics, but rather as a result of social, economic and environmental factors. To talk about health, not healthcare, and hate as a public health issue, we're joined in the studio by Dr. Sandro Galea. He's Dean of Boston University's School of Public Health, and he's held many other very senior academic posts. His latest book is Well, What We Need to Talk About When We Talk About Health. And Sandro's here in Australia as a guest at the Australian Partnership Prevention Centre. Sandro, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
We hear with painful, tragic regularity the stories of mass shootings in American schools, churches, shopping malls, etc. A big concern for law enforcement, but you also see gun violence as a public health issue.
Absolutely. The scale of gun violence, the numbers are always staggering. There's about one mass shooting a day in America. About 40,000 people die from guns every year. Another probably 80,000 to 100,000 are injured. So those are just the numbers. Then the question is, as a former Surgeon General said, to paraphrase a little bit, if so many people are dying from it or are being injured by it, why is it not a health issue? So of course it's a health issue. It is something that is affecting the health of large numbers of people in the American population, and suicides in particular are contributing to a decline in life expectancy in America. So yes, it's a public health issue.
So each of the incidents of terror appear to have been motivated by hatred on the perpetrator's part, or of groups that were different from them.
Mm-hmm. You know, hate means dislike of the other. Hate is about disliking other people, and in many respects, it is a fundamental determinant of a desire to hurt others in whatever way one does that. So I would consider hate to be a driver of health, yes, because it drives people's actions that marginalize others and that hurt others.
Well, at its most epic scale, it leads to Holocaust, for example. It leads to genocidal onslaughts on whoever is deemed to be the other.
Absolutely. And this is why I think it's important to have the conversation, because it says, well, what is it that makes people hate others to begin with? And it is marginalizing people. It's labeling them as different. It's stigmatizing them. It's dehumanizing people. And we see those trends in global political conversations right now, which is what makes the current moment so dangerous.
Racism, discrimination themselves produce negative health consequences, as does outgroup marginalization, including Islamophobia.
It does. And we say there's good evidence that all of these forces are associated with mental health directly by people who experience them, and physical health because of lack of access to resources. For example, people who are marginalized, discriminated against, have less access to clean air, safe water, safe foods, parks, places to exercise. All of that is a downstream consequence of a dislike and of marginalization.
I remember doing a program years ago on mental health, physical health and powerlessness.
Yes.
And the study we looked at involved English public servants, British public servants. And it was quite extraordinary to find the higher up in the echelons of the public service, the healthier that person was, both mentally and physically. As you went down the ladder as people were less powerful, they were less healthy. That finding would not surprise you for a moment.
Not at all. And there's the classic Whitehall study. The book that you just mentioned, the first three chapters are about power, money, and place. Power is probably the most fundamental determinant of our health, because power at the individual level gives one control and autonomy. At the structural level, it shapes the social, economic, environmental conditions that you referred to, and those are ultimately what creates our health.
Would you argue that the gun laws in the US, bad and insane as they are not necessarily the driving force in gun crime, but hatred itself?
I don't think the gun laws are the driving force. I think it's the interpretation of particular gun laws and the widespread availability of guns. And ultimately, it's the availability of guns that give voice to our darkest angels. Guns give voice to hate. And what we have in the United States right now is a terrible confluence where we are giving license to voices that will promote hate and ready availability of guns that allow those who wish to do harm readily.
But gun massacres are often motivated, it would seem to me, by people who feel blinded with rage and overwhelmingly lacking in power. Even the gun doesn't give them that.
Well, it gives them power in the immediate short term over a few people in that space of time, which is, of course, what makes them so tragic. But we shouldn't forget that although we talk about massacres and large-scale gun events, those are a minority of gun-related deaths. The majority of gun-related deaths, and by majority I mean 98%, are one-on-one events, and a majority of those are suicides. And that is what the widespread availability of guns does.
Sandro, free, or someone might say hate speech, and the right to bear arms are so entrenched and fundamental to American society and identity. What could the medical profession possibly do?
At the end of the day, I think this is about changing the conversation. Speech has consequences. What we say has consequences for what we do. And the medical profession is seen as a reliable and an expert witness, so to speak, about what it is that harms our health. So I have argued that the medical profession has a responsibility to speak about these issues so that it can shift the national and global conversation.
Unlike most nations, hate speech is effectively constitutionally protected in the US. There are, as I understand it, no hate speech laws currently in existence.
The United States has a complicated relationship with what speech is allowed. The notion that all speech is allowed is, of course, false, because there are all sorts of buffers around what speech is allowed, particularly when speech is there to hurt others. At the same time, there's a very strong system of protecting people's rights to say what they wish to say. But all of that has to be buffered by others who use speech to protect us from deleterious speech. And what we're seeing sometimes is an imbalance of those speeches.
Now, those of you in population health accept that hate speech is a medical issue.
It should be.
How do we get there from here?
I think we get there by having this conversation. You know, when if you were to survey most of your listeners before this segment, I bet most of them would not have thought of hate as a health issue. And having this conversation puts it on the agenda, makes it acceptable for us to say that we should be mitigating the consequences of hate because it's bad for our health. And ultimately, our health is a shared value across political spectrum, right, left, Australia, US.
I made the point in introducing you that the slow motion horrors of drought,
yes,
can have the most devastating effect on public health, mental health.
Absolutely.
And we're seeing what is nothing short of an epidemic of suicide as a consequence.
We are. And drought is a good example, because the fundamental cause of these droughts, of course, is climate change. Global environmental climate change results in extreme weather events. Those extreme weather events have health consequences, mental health and physical health.
And the ravaging of the environment also has emotional effects on the population, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And insofar as our health depends on the air we breathe, the water we drink, all of that depends on the environment.
So you suggest, as I understand, four steps. And the first is recognize hate crimes as an assault on population health.
That's right.
Push back on hate. How do you do that? That's the second.
I think it's by being unyielding in saying that hate is going to harm our health, all of us, not just victims, but also perpetrators, because it is changing our social fabric and it is chipping away at the full scale of the social ecosystem that keeps us all healthy. So we need to recognize that it's not just affecting you, it's also affecting me.
The president-elect of the American College of Surgeons has stated, our profession requires us to fight the challenge for equity for the most vulnerable amongst us. Being a moral leader means standing up for truth, reason, and science. It means not being afraid to stand up for your principles or hold elected leaders accountable for meeting the needs and values of our communities. Heavens above, Sandra, we're having this conversation while you have a president who, in fact, operates via hate speech, inculcates this sort of division, constantly points to the other.
Insofar as one of the central roles of leadership, perhaps the central role of leadership, is to set norms and values. When you have leaders in any country who are then using their platform to sow hate, to sow social divisions, to create values that are going to harm their citizens, to my mind, they are abrogating their fundamental responsibility as leaders.
It's crept up on us a bit, though, hasn't it? It didn't happen overnight. It's happened in increments, and now it's the new norm.
There are very powerful forces at play, but I think one of the forces that has really been determinative here is inequality, that while we were, and by we I mean many of us in the Western world, were busy applauding ourselves that the world is becoming a better place, we did not stop long enough to realize that half the world was being left behind, and that created these divisions that has made way for these political movements.
Your third argument is that we should play a role in disarming hate. Can you talk to that? You say that we can sue the manufacturers of a faulty toaster that causes harm, but you can't sue the manufacturers of guns and assault rifles.
That's correct. And this goes to my point that guns give voice to hate. In many respects, if those who hate have only spoons at their disposal, there's only so much harm they can do. So the sequence of what we should do is recognize that hate harms us, make that part of the conversation, and remove the means by which those who are hating have to hurt others.
Has the medical profession thus far been playing a role in this area, or is it just beginning now to happen?
I think in many ways, as a whole, it's just beginning to happen. That should not undermine the fact that there have been parts of the medical profession, particularly in social medicine, who have been very engaged with this for decades and decades, particularly in places like South America. But the medical profession as a whole, ironically, is embracing this issue now because of pushback from lobbying groups like the NRA and their infamous tweet asking the medical profession to stay in their lane, which resulted in, of course, the exact opposite, but taking the mainstream of the medical profession and making it, incensing it and saying, this is our lane because health is our lane.
I think it's time for you to talk about your formative experiences as a young doctor working in Somalia, how that influenced your outlook on health and healthcare.
Yeah, I was working with Doctors Without Borders in Somalia. This was in the mid-late 90s. At the time, of course, Somalia was quite torn apart by war, still is in many respects. And I was the only doctor for a large region, so I was seeing patients and healing people every day. And the effect it had on me was it really made me question what I was doing, meaning I was doing good on a one-to-one basis, but I wanted to know what was causing the problem to begin with. How could I contribute to being part of a lasting solution? And that really transformed my thinking from seeing my role as being an individual medical provider, a physician who does one-on-one work, to thinking about the health of populations.
So what's your prescription for better health?
My fundamental prescription is that we need to change how we talk about health. We're talking about, as you said at the beginning, health, not healthcare. And we need to understand, every one of your listeners needs to understand that our health is determined by the world around us, is determined by housing, by economic opportunity, by healthy food, by parks for opportunity for recreation, by gender equity, by less violence. Once we understand that, it changes how we think about health and it changes what we demand of our politicians and our business leaders, because we should demand those forces to generate health.
So we've become so focused on treating disease that we've forgotten to look at what's causing people to fall ill in the first place.
We're confusing healthcare with health. You know, you and I want a good doctor for when we're sick, but ideally, we would like not to be sick to begin with.
So the first step is to change the way we talk about health at a grassroots as well as at the policy level.
Absolutely, because the policy...
This conversation has to be all-embracing.
This conversation has to change the world because ultimately, of course, policy follows the public conversation.
So seeing health for what it is, a result of factors embedded in everyday life, is crucial. And that's just as important as a new MRI machine.
It is, one would argue, more important. One would argue it has greater return on investment. If we all had stable housing, if we all had housing that generated health, if we all had stable employment, we would be a much healthier world. And perhaps the abject example here is the United States, where we have lost 5 years of life expectancy compared to places like Australia because we have disinvested in these other forces.
Sandro, you like to tell stories to illustrate your point. In your latest book, Well, there's a composite character called Sophia. Tell us about Sophia.
The point I make about Sophia is you can see Sophia for the first time as a middle-aged woman. She's 40 pounds overweight, goes to her doctor, has type 2 diabetes, and needs a new knee because she's overweight. That's one way of seeing Sophia, which is a typical way of seeing a patient. Another way of seeing Sophia is to say, let's take Sophia from her childhood and realize that she was born to a single mother. She was left by herself to watch TV because her mother cared for her. As a result, she had two jobs, ate potato chips, gained some weight, was a very good student but could never take advantage of that because she had to look after her sister after school, took a manual labor job, was standing on her feet all the time, developed diabetes and had asthma because she lived in poor housing next to diesel-spewing trucks. Now she becomes a 45-year-old woman who's overweight and needs a new knee. And when you see it that way, you realize that the treatment for Sophia, maybe for this Sophia, is a new set of knees. But the real treatment for all the Sophias of the world is dealing with them from when they were young and making sure that she has the opportunities to realize her potential, making sure she's eating healthy food, making sure she has jobs that are not hurting her knees, making sure she's not around diesel-spewing trucks.
Would you share my view that the war on drugs has not only been counterproductive but entirely wrong-headed, that by criminalizing addiction rather than treating it as a public health issue, we've made terrible mistakes?
I couldn't agree more, and I would add to that that the war on drugs has also resulted in enormous inequity, where minorities, racial minorities, have suffered the greatest burden of that.
Well, in terms of the imprisonment rates, the demographics of that in the US are
horrific.
Are terrible.
Absolutely.
Okay. Tell me finally, and we've only got a minute to do it, tell me about Blind Willie Johnson, another of your anecdotes.
So Blind Willie Johnson was born in Texas, southern United States, at the turn of the 20th century. He was born sighted, but he lost his vision, domestic violence incident. He grew up poor and blind and black in Texas. When he was in his early 40s, his wife, he developed malaria. His wife took him to hospital and he was turned away. And it's not clear if he was turned away because he was poor, because he was blind, he was black. And then he died. And the reason for the anecdote is, well, what killed him? What killed him was malaria. But when I tell that story, it's clear it wasn't just malaria. It was also racism. It was domestic violence. It was poor access to care. All those other forces killed Blind Willie Johnson. And those are the forces that generate our health.
I wish we had time to discuss the Australian situation because you write about that quite knowingly. And that is that while we spend big on health, we don't necessarily spend it very sensibly. But Sandro, it is a great pleasure to talk to you. So what small changes we could make would result in a big difference in terms of healthier outcomes.
If every listener has this conversation with 10 of their friends, together we can change the conversation.
Simple as that.
It is as simple as that. It's my challenge
to us
all.
So despite all your experiences, all your observations, you're still optimistic.
Of course. Optimism is much better than the alternative.
Well, I wish I shared it. Dr. Sandro Galea, Dean of the School of Public Health at Boston University, his latest book is Well, What We Need to Talk About When We Talk About Health. And he's here in Australia as a guest of the Australian Partnership Prevention Centre.